I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. I want to welcome our listeners to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about a really interesting phenomenon in American politics, in American history, in American public life, and try to understand something about that moment in America and maybe what it means for today, if it has any echoes in contemporary times. And we're going to be talking today about the Bull Moose Party. Some of you, many of our listeners have heard of it, but how much do we really know about it, what it was, what caused it, and what effects it had and perhaps continues to have? Joined for the conversation by Professor Mike Cullinane. Mike is professor of U.S. history at Dickinson State University, where he is the Loman Walton Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies. Also, the host of a podcast on the Gilded Age and Progressive Era. And let me recommend that to our listeners. We all love history here. We want our folks to be historically informed. It's a terrific podcast. Want to recommend that. And also, of course, a prolific author, written a number of books, including Remembering Theodore Roosevelt and Theodore Roosevelt's Ghost. Again, let me highly recommend those to our listeners as well. Mike, thanks for joining us on The American Idea.
Thanks so much for having me on, Jeff.
The Bull Moose Party, even the name is interesting. And I think a lot of people, certainly our listeners, know that it's somewhere around the early 20th century, and it has some connection to Theodore Roosevelt. Talk about the Bull Moose Party and its origin.
Sure. Well, it does have everything to do with Theodore Roosevelt and much to do with the people that surrounded Theodore Roosevelt during his presidency. So the Bull Moose Party gets his name from Theodore Roosevelt, who referred to himself as a bull moose. And the party itself starts when Roosevelt fails to win the nomination to the Republican Party in 1912. So he runs against William Howard Taft, who is the incumbent president and his handpicked successor. And their falling out, which was political in nature as well as personality driven, their falling out led to a really, I would say, kind of eruption of ideas in the 1912 campaign. It's one of these presidential campaigns that marks a turning point in the party system in America. And what Roosevelt did was he tried to win over the Republican Party through the primaries. These are the first primaries that are ever held in America in 1912. He wins 8 out of the 13 states, and he thinks that this makes him a lock for the nomination at the convention in the summer. But Taft controls the party machinery and eventually wins the nomination, forcing effectively Roosevelt to either drop out or to start his own third party. And of course, we know he does the latter. And in 1912, the Bull Moose Party is born, and it is born of the progressive ideals of many former Republicans who bolt from the party just as Roosevelt does to start this new campaign, this third party campaign, which incidentally is going to wind up being the most successful third party campaign in 20th century history.
So that's interesting to me. The Bull Moose Party itself, what your response there just suggests, is it a personality party, Bull Moose, Teddy Roosevelt? It is an ideas party, progressivism and progressive ideas, or is it somehow both?
It is somehow both, yes. It is strange to think. I mean, in many ways, what we look at today with the Republican Party is the party of Trump. And we talk less about ideas, but the Bull Moose Party was strangely both of those things in the sense that without Theodore Roosevelt, it didn't exist. And I can say that quite certainty. TR in 1914, when he leaves the Bull Moose Party, the party effectively collapses. It continues on in some forms, but it's not the same party. So without TR, this party doesn't exist. However, the ideas that are the backstop of the party, things like national health care, women's suffrage, the direct election of senators, inheritance taxes, all of which have some relevance today into our current democracy. But all of those ideas are formed by other people within the Progressive Party that have been influencing Theodore Roosevelt over the last decade. So Jane Addams, for example, is one of the chief advocates for women's suffrage. She actually nominates Roosevelt at the contest, at the convention, I should say, in 1912. And there's other people that are, you know, that are wonks and bureaucrats that are influencing Roosevelt to adopt these policies. It is not just the party of TR.
That's interesting, because I think if we're our listeners today, we typically associate the word progressive, if we're talking in political terms, with the Democratic Party and conservative with the Republican Party. Here you have Teddy Roosevelt, a self-described and certainly self-embracing progressive, starts as a Republican. Can you take our listeners back to 1912 and kind of situate the political parties and how we could possibly have someone like Teddy Roosevelt, who had been a Republican, become a bull moose?
I mean, it's a great question, because I think really this election is pivotal. It brings progressivism to the forefront of American politics. The Democratic Party, really in the 19th century, the late 19th century particularly, was a mix of conservative Southern Democrats and populist Midwestern and sometimes Western politicians. So the populists were certainly, to a certain extent, progressive, but the Southern Democrats were not particularly of that progressive ilk. The Republican Party had a blend like this too. It had Northern industrialists who were rather conservative about tariffs and trade, but more progressive on, say, some social issues or on direct democracy. So ultimately, what happens is we get a rearranging of the political parties. It's the whirlwind of Theodore Roosevelt that makes this happen. So when he joins the race in 1912 as an independent, as a third party candidate, a bull mooser, the Democratic Party shifts. And it was planning on nominating Champ Clark, who was the Speaker of the House, a Western, fairly conservative Democrat. But instead, they opt for Southern born, but New Jersey reared, at least on politics, Woodrow Wilson. And Woodrow Wilson is advocating for a much more progressive view. In fact, one that is, in terms of the American economy, very similar to what Theodore Roosevelt is arguing for. So the whole spectrum of American politics lunges to the left in 1912. So on issues like the 8-hour workday, all of the parties are largely aligned because the electorate has kind of signed off on that as something that they wanted to see happen. Or issues like, you know, the Federal Trade Commission that would come into being in 1914, Theodore Roosevelt had advocated and, in fact, instated through a Bureau of Corporations while he was president. These things, these sort of progressive ideas, had been the mainstay of his administration, and they become the mainstay of the entire campaign for all of the parties. So that's what a really good third-party candidate can do. It can make the political spectrum lurch in one direction.
So that's really interesting. So if the Democratic Party then goes from a more conservative party to a more progressive party, the Republican Party has, and then of course the bull moose is the progressive party, as it says, the Republican Party, what happens to it? Because it still has William Howard Taft.
It does. I mean, the Republican Party effectively mops up all of the Republican conservative votes. I mean, it's funny, if you look at the elections in, say, 1908 and compare it to 1912, Taft gets something in the region of 6.5 million votes, and the Republican candidate, Bryan, William Jennings Bryan, gets somewhere in the region of 5 million. Now, those figures are off and they're rough, but I'm only using them to say that in 1912, if you combine the votes of Theodore Roosevelt and Taft, the numbers are pretty darn close to what they were in 1908. The only difference being is that they're split between two candidates. Wilson doesn't pick up that many more votes and win the election. He wins by a plurality. I think he gets something in the region of 41%, which isn't too far off from what Taft had gotten in what Bryan had gotten in 1908. Here's the other irritant in 1912, and this is why the election is certainly seen as super left, really, by many. There's 1 million votes that are cast for Eugene V. Debs, who is the socialist candidate for president.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. That's a huge
number.
The powerful appeal of Debs and what effect that has.
I mean, Debs certainly appealed to the working class. I mean, the number of industrial actions that had happened in the 1890s and early 1900s led to Debs becoming a popular candidate. Of course, he leads the Pullman strike in 1893, which really cripples the railroad industry for a number of years. But Debs has this appeal, but he is the leftist of all lefts in this campaign. And he draws like 6% of the vote, which is in and around 1 million votes. It's an astronomical number for the time. And it just goes to show how the political spectrum has really moved far beyond what it was in the early 20th century, the first few years of the 20th century.
So that's fascinating. If we line them up left to right, and I know it's not always easy to do that, take us from left to right among the four candidates that are running in 1912.
Sure. So on the farthest left has got to be Debs, the socialist candidate. I would say next to Debs is Roosevelt as the progressive, but I would still say that Roosevelt is very much a center-left candidate. Wilson is also a center candidate, maybe more center than center-left. And then on the right is William Howard Taft, who actually, as Republicans go, is not the most conservative in his party. So everyone on this spectrum, I would say, is either a center or center-left or left candidate. There is no one running on the right in 1912.
That's fascinating. What do Republicans think of Teddy Roosevelt? Do they think, okay, he's showing us something that we need and we need to make some reforms and adjustments, or is he a traitor who has to be defeated?
Yeah, I mean, he's betrayed the party is what most people think that have not already bolted the party. These are even really good friends of Roosevelt's, people like Henry Cabot Lodge, who would have been a longtime political supporter, and then people like Elihu Root, who is a New York senator at the time, but was Theodore Roosevelt's Secretary of State. In fact, Root is the chairman at the convention, the Republican convention in 1912, and he's the one that swings the votes to Taft. So there definitely is a schism within the party, and Roosevelt is seen as a Brutus in many ways, and one that needs to be defeated. And I think Roosevelt, in terms of defeat, I think he actually expected defeat at some stage. You know, this was a long shot run for the White House. It wasn't something that he, I think, went into feeling that he was going to win, but it was the conviction of the ideas and that the Republican Party had lost its way. That's why he gets involved.
Did he think of himself and his progressive ideas as a new thing in the country, or at least in the Republican Party? Or did he think of himself as sort of continuing some other American or Republican tradition?
Yes. Yes to both of them. I mean, you know, Roosevelt was he was a big fan of Abraham Lincoln. He was his role model as a politician. And so he did see a link between Lincoln, the Reconstruction Constitution, and the ideas of industrial equality for all. I mean, this is really Roosevelt's big contribution to the country, is that he was trying to modify or adjust some of the issues that had taken over the country through industrialization.
And his views, as you say, were pulled everybody, many people to the left, although it's an era, as you say, 1912, of a lot of social and socialist ferment, right? So everybody, the context is pulling people to the left. TR and the force of his personality is pulling people to the left. What are the major issues, if there are any, that are dividing the Bull Moose Party from the Democrats and the Bull Moose Party from the Republicans?
That's a great question. I think that goes to your previous question about what made TR different as a politician. So he's in the same political tradition as the Republican Party back to Lincoln in his own mind, but it's industrialization and the transgressions of large corporate companies and small corporate companies possibly too, that have really reshaped the fabric of society in the late 19th century. And he's trying to address that. So things like bossism and good government was something that he cut his teeth on when he was an assemblyman in New York, when he was governor of New York, when he was a civil service commissioner. So this is something, good governance and transparency in government and efficiency as well, I should say. These are all things that are really important to him, and they become really important to the Progressive Party. Now, to the contrary, the Republican Party is still a party of bosses. And, you know, you could see this in New York with Boss Platt, who is still, you know, knocking around and controlling the levers of power. So when Roosevelt is arguing for direct democracy in 1912, he's echoing activists who had said that they wanted senators to be directly elected, which was often decided by the bosses. In fact, Senator Platt was a boss and a senator at one time. So that's one thing. The other thing in terms of moderating the perils and the evils of industrialization was that Roosevelt wanted to see greater antitrust laws, stronger punishments for companies that broke those laws, and not a limit to limited liability, but a prosecution of companies that were going to stray beyond the law. And that's something that came in gradually that he was advocating for. And I think the reason why Wilson will eventually start the Federal Trade Commission is because Roosevelt had set a lot of that precedent with the Department of Commerce and Labor during his presidency. And he's still calling for that in 1912. The other thing is equality, and this harkens back to the Reconstruction Constitution, and maybe this is some continuity as well as change, but you know, the recognition that women deserve the right to vote was a step change in American politics. And although he didn't do it as president, I think he recognized by 1912 that was a mistake, and he should have been braver when he was president. In fact, Elizabeth Cady Stanton writes a letter to him when he's president. It's one of her last letters, in which she writes, you know, you should advocate for women's suffrage. It will make you immortal. And although he doesn't do it as president, he does do it as a candidate in 1912. And that does move the dial in terms of women's equality. I wish I could say the same around race. TR does not have the same record on race.
About civil rights. I was going to ask that question about civil rights, and where does civil rights for African Americans fit in the Bull Moose platform? Some people would have thought, I think, that TR was relatively progressive on issues of race, at least compared to others of the time. But does that translate to the Bull Moose Party?
I mean, he's got a mixed record on race, certainly. So there are, you know, moments of real light and, you know, excitement when he invites Booker T. Washington to the White House for dinner. In the same way, he also dismissed a troop of African-American soldiers from Brownsville without any evidence that they had done anything wrong. They were accused of violence and murder, and that wasn't the case. So they were dishonorably discharged for a crime they didn't commit. So there's that. I mean, it's interesting. In 1912, you know, he's starting to talk more with W.E.B. Du Bois about racial justice, and he's constantly talking about social justice, and he would include in that African-Americans. But it's not as outspoken as some of his other advocacy and certainly other parts of his platform. And as a result, I don't think we can say that the Bull Moose platform was one that was stridently pro-civil rights. I think it was pro-civil rights in the sense that Roosevelt believed that all Americans were entitled to the same rights. And that's his faith in the Reconstruction Constitution. But I don't think he ever specifically said in 1912 that has to include African-Americans as well, which is really what the nation was sort of hankering for, and certainly that the African-American community was hankering for.
Right. So does he get significant African-American support electorally in 1912, or do they continue to vote for the Republican Party?
It's really a mixed bag. So in some states, he does pick up African-American support, and in other states, he doesn't. In the northern states, New York swings behind Taft, And other states, though, in the North will swing behind Roosevelt. I don't think the African American vote has as much of an impact in 1912 as it would in later elections. You know, it didn't go one way for Taft or Roosevelt. It was largely split. And it was split more on ideological grounds about progressivism or conservatism, Republican conservatism, but not so much on the race issue. Taft was arguing exactly as Roosevelt did, civil rights for all, but not specifically saying, you know, we're going to make sure that African Americans are protected anywhere beyond what they already were protected by. Now, what I will say is that Wilson doesn't pick up many votes. And of course, what Wilson will do as president is to segregate the federal workforce. That is something that both Taft and Roosevelt thought were abhorrent and what their party was against since the Civil War, which was that the federal government needed to act as a model for the rest of the country. And Wilson, of course, you know, he doesn't do that.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
Yeah, in fact, I was thinking, as you were talking about that, what was Woodrow Wilson and the Democrats' view of the Bull Moose Party? Did they immediately recognize, hey, this is going to split the Republican vote? Or did they fear, uh-oh, they're going to take some of the progressive vote away from us? And they were afraid. Did they help the Bull Moose Party in subtle ways at all? Or did they think, no, they're a threat to us?
I think they thought that this was a major victory for the Democratic Party, because the Democrats had been really shut out since Grover Cleveland's time. And Roosevelt was hugely popular, but this was a split that opened the door for the Democrats. And they do start to model some of their policies on the Bull Moose Party in an effort to win over some of what would be Bull Moose voters. So things like Roosevelt's New Nationalism speech, which he makes all the way back in 1911, I think, that speech is really what lays out for Republicans what the progressive side of the party should look like. So all those policy platforms that I mentioned, they're kind of encapsulated in this really remarkable speech. Woodrow Wilson will lay out in his own policy platform what he calls the new freedom, which sounds an awful lot like the new nationalism. And actually, yeah, right. when you read it, I mean, it's very similar. So this was an attempt to co-opt the ideas of the Bull Moose Party, run with the brand of the Democrats, but with a noticeable tilt to the left. And yet they would have kept a lot of the policies that they were looking forward to bringing into power, which had been, you know, they'd been out of power for so long. So I think, yes, they are trying to co-opt things from the Bull Moose Party.
Thinking about the reason that Roosevelt ran, you know, he knew it was going to split the Republican Party. That, as you just said, the Democrats knew he was going to split the Republican Party. You said he knew it was kind of a long shot. All right. Why then does he run? You said at the beginning, it's a combination of principle and his personal relations with Taft. Tell us about his personal relationship with William Howard Taft.
Well, I mean, this is a question that I think we have to go back to 1909 to think about, because this is when he's leaving the White House. I mean, he leaves the White House in 1909. Of course, he's thinking about leaving much earlier than that. In fact, in 1904, when he wins, he says he won't run for another term. So he's kind of a lame duck, although he doesn't act like one, of course. But by the time 1908 rolls around, he's looking for a successor, and he really wants to pick Elihu Root. He thinks that Root is the man for the job, but Root hates campaigning and really generally hates socializing, and so he's not the right person. Roosevelt famously said that he couldn't be elected dog catcher. But Taft has some of the same qualities as Root. He's a really good bureaucrat. He has a good handle on how the offices of government work. Politically, he's very much aligned to Roosevelt in the sense that he is a fairly progressive among the Republicans, at least anyway. So Taft gets the nod in 1908 from TR, and TR actively campaigns for him, and Taft wins by a good margin, but not as much as Roosevelt won by in 1904. And this goes back to my thinking about, well, what was Roosevelt really trying to think about in a successor? And I think he wanted someone that wouldn't overshadow him. He wouldn't want someone that would kind of steal the glory of the Roosevelt years. And yet he wanted someone that would stick closely, or as closely as possible, to the policies of his administration. Now, when 1910 rolls around, Roosevelt actually leaves the country. He goes to Africa for 9 months and then Europe for another month to kind of get away from Washington and give Taft a little bit of breathing room, which I think is a very generous thing on his part. But what it does lead to is Taft straying fairly far from what Roosevelt had intended his administration. The direction of travel was basically changing. It was more of Taft's White House, which is natural, but Roosevelt didn't like that. So Taft appointed many of his own men in 1909. Some people that TR wanted to see in the cabinet didn't make it in. Taft started moving in a different direction with conservation. He started moving in a different direction with the tariff. He started moving in a different direction around corporate regulation. And so people start, you know, friends of Roosevelt start chirping in his ear that this new administration doesn't look like your administration. And what it boils down to in 1911, 1912, is that TR believes that he can win the Republican Party. He's got enough support, he feels, that he could win it. I don't think he expected to lose that race. I do think he expected to lose the Bull Moose race. But by the time he had, quote unquote, put his hat in the ring, he was all in for 1912. So whether it was as the Republican Party candidate, or as it turns out, not, he was committed to running and to pursuing this agenda, the new nationalism agenda that he had set out. So a lot of this has to do with ego, I think. It always does with politicians. You know, anyone who tells you a politician doesn't have an ego is probably a politician. but the other thing is that I think once you've committed to something, and this is a very Rooseveltian thing, I suppose, once he commits to something, it's very hard for him to pull back and see a way of, you know, releasing himself from the situation.
It's interesting to me when I think about some of the primary documents and speeches of Roosevelt and Taft. In particular, one of the things that I've noticed is they seem to have, or at least they said they had, very different views of the presidency. And one of the things that TR criticizes Taft for is not having a robust enough, big enough view of the presidency. Sometimes political scientists call it the stewardship theory of the presidency. Can you talk about the split between them on that particular issue?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that is exactly what it is. I mean, it manifests itself in policy, but it's the way you operate the government, the bureaucracy, the executive branch. And TR actually used that word and coined that word, the steward theory, or the stewardship theory. And what he believed in, I mean, which is the modern presidency. I mean, in many ways, Theodore Roosevelt created the modern presidency, which is that he coined the term the bully pulpit, which means that the president has got a great platform in which to speak to the American people. And he did that. He spoke directly to the American people. So rather than going to Congress and lobbying Congress, he said the American people can decide for themselves and they elect Congress. So this was turning the old politics of the 19th century on its head. The other thing was that he had very clear ideas, not only his own, but brought to him by his friends and colleagues, very clear ideas of the direction that he wanted to go in, whether it was on conservation or corporate regulation or Native American rights or African American. He had very clear ideas, foreign policy as well. And so that helped him appoint people to positions that shared his values. Now, Taft didn't do that. Taft appointed people for political reasons. So if you look at Taft's cabinet, they come from, you know, the most important Republican states. And he wouldn't appoint more than one person from those states because that would be a political misstep, right? And this is going back to the bossism inherent in the Republican Party in the 19th century. So Taft also is more deferential to Congress than Roosevelt would. Now, maybe that's not entirely his fault. Theodore Roosevelt appointed a number of commissions during his time without the permission of Congress. He did things like preserve a number of national forests or game preserves without, you know, basically by decree, by executive order, and made a number of proclamations that did much of the same thing. So Taft was a little bit hamstrung because the president who went before him had gone so far with executive power that Congress had actively rolled back the president's powers. I mean, TR effectively saw unenumerated powers, those that are not expressly written into the Constitution, as his to do with as he pleases. Taft, by the time he became president, Congress had literally limited some of those powers explicitly in some cases. And so he wasn't able to do the same things in the same way. But here's the question. Would Taft have done it anyway? I don't think so. He was a much more deferential president than TR was, regardless of the new statutes that were on the book.
Yeah, because it strikes me, I'm thinking some of Taft's lectures, I think it's at Yale Law School or somewhere, where he sort of replies to TR's view of the presidency. And it seemed like TR was saying, look, as president, I thought I could do anything that wasn't forbidden to me. And Taft seems to say, I think it's the opposite. The president should do what he is authorized to do explicitly or maybe with his implied powers. But there isn't this undefined residuum, I think Taft calls it, of power. And Roosevelt said, absolutely there is, and I'm going to use it.
Well, and this is great stuff because this is exactly what we argue about today, about where power rests in our government today. And they are two very different views. Ironically, they're from the same party too, which, you know, you would think they might be two different parties, but actually this is almost, you know, the debates that we see in the Supreme Court today about where these powers reside. Is it with the states? Is it with the federal government? And, you know, Taft took a very moderate view on this. He believed that states had jurisdiction, but that the federal government did too, but it was nothing like TR. TR believed that federal jurisdiction, you know, and the Supremacy Clause trumped just about everything. And then in terms of how the executive departments worked as well, TR gave great latitude to cabinet members and even agencies within the cabinet. You know, this is the burgeoning administrative state, which we are still talking about today. You know, that was built really under Roosevelt. And in 1903, the foundation of the Department of Labor and Commerce is the testing ground for how far the government can go. Can it prosecute a corporation for regulations, antitrust regulations? I mean, that's literally tested under Roosevelt. Can they go after, you know, bureaus and agencies within the government for not doing things the same way? You know, whether it's state or local or, you know, municipal governments, can they go after them? Can they go after mobs that lynch African Americans in the South? Because that's of course a criminal act, which is normally reserved for the states. Roosevelt argues, no, this is something that we can prosecute within the 14th Amendment. So it's a crisis in a sense that we are still living with today, which is very much about where does the power rest and who gets to act.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. Your point is really a good one. Really, under Roosevelt, he sort of establishes what the modern presidency has become. And it's really interesting to me if you start thinking about the effects of TR and the Bull Moose Party shaping the presidency. Because today, no matter what people say when they run for office, it seems to me, and some openly, explicitly embrace it, everybody who runs, Democrat, Republican, doesn't matter, embraces a Teddy Roosevelt view of the presidency.
And I think going back to your question about why 1912 is so important, the reason why it's so important is that, and you mentioned all the activism that had been going on as well, but by 1912, Taft's, you know, crushing loss in that election means that his view of the presidency is not the one that the people want. The people are looking for either the Bull Moose version or what Wilson is going to advocate, which is the same as the modern presidency under Roosevelt, really, expansive powers, stewardship. And here's the thing, when we look at the Bull Moose Party and the Democratic Party of Roosevelt and Wilson, what we see is the American people saying that they're happy for the government to intervene in their lives more than they had in the 19th century. That they're happy to intervene in their lives when it comes to consumer rights, business regulation, interstate commerce, you know, but even civil rights and in the case of suffrage, women's rights. So this is the step change that 1912 is the we don't really question government's place in the lives of everyday Americans. We question the degree to which the government is involved, but that's a very different question than should it be involved, right?
So that's really interesting because I think a lot of our folks would think, the federal government being activist and involved in people's daily lives and economics and all the areas you mentioned, that starts with Franklin Roosevelt in 32. And you're saying, no, it starts with Teddy Roosevelt.
It absolutely starts with Teddy Roosevelt. And I think the questions that stem from that are really down to the context. It's industrialization that makes that happen. The country before the 1880s, 1870s is an agrarian country. And within the 30 years from 1870 to 1900, the industrialization of the country throws up so many questions. Questions about sexuality and gender, questions about marketplaces and economics, you know, questions about who owns what, who are the haves, who are the have-nots. And all of that transforms our society. Now, the only thing that I can say that might be relatable is that the information revolution that we are going through now and the prospect of, you know, the internet and the AI revolution that might be coming is that if you think back 30 years ago, we didn't have those things. We didn't have, well, we didn't have the internet. We certainly didn't have, you know, handheld mobile devices, computing devices in our hands. We definitely didn't have AI. This is the same step change. And if you can think about it, the presidency is probably going to change with this too. You know, in the same way that Roosevelt had to deal with industrialization and the transformation of society, our presidents today are going to have to think about how we deal with the step change from an industrial economy to an information-based economy.
Lessons that we take away from the Bull Moose Party and from Teddy Roosevelt's run. You know, one thing people had mentioned, for example, is if Donald Trump didn't get the Republican nomination this year, even though now it seems pretty obvious he's going to, if he wasn't going to get it, some people speculated he'll do what Teddy Roosevelt did and run as a third party. Did Teddy Roosevelt inspire third party runs for the 20th century and into the 21st?
Absolutely, without question, yes. So, and the Progressive Party does continue on in different guises and forms. In fact, led by an acolyte, maybe reluctant acolyte, of Theodore Roosevelt's, who is Bob La Follette from Wisconsin, senator from Wisconsin, progressive, runs under the progressive banner in the 1920s twice, and has largely the same platform as Roosevelt, although they disliked each other immensely. And Roosevelt saw La Follette as too left, or too left to him, I guess. But other 20th century campaigns, I think, will be inspired by Roosevelt as well. Perhaps most notably, Ross Perot in the 1992 and 1996 campaigns. You know, right. Also extremely successful, moving the dial. Not, I don't think, in a liberal or progressive way, but actually in a rather conservative way, moving the dial a little bit to the right. He stole votes probably from George W. Bush. But the idea that Perot had was that a big personality with big ideas would be able to make a real dent in the campaign and move the dial, right? And I think that's the other thing that's happened since Perot's, good showing, not victory, of course, but since Perot's good showing, other candidates have said the same as well, that they're going to get involved because they can move the dial. And it starts often within a party. So you have candidates that are saying, you know, I'm advocating for, like Herman Cain, I'm advocating for a sales tax, a flat sales tax on everything. You know, that was his big issue. And then other candidates start picking that up as well. So the common thing about third party candidates is that they don't win, but they do influence the election. And that is something to be said.
When TR looked back and his life, because he lived a number of years right past 1912, when he looked back on his life and that run, what did he think about it?
That's a good question. I'd have to dig through some letters to go there. But he lives for another 8 years. Sorry, not 8 years, 7 years. He dies in January 1919. So actually, it's a little bit less than that. But he's still very politically involved. But he returns to the Republican Party. He helps Charles Evan Hughes nearly beat Wilson in 1916. If more of TR's friends had gotten on board with Charles Evan Hughes, he would have been the president. In fact, even if just TR's California friends got on board, Hughes would have been president. He loses California by like 2,000 votes in 1916.
So TR got back on board, but he couldn't bring his friends with him.
Well, interestingly enough, Hiram Morgan, who was TR's running mate in 1912, who goes on to become a really influential progressive senator and governor in California, he has a negative meeting with Hughes. In fact, it's not a meeting at all. They don't meet. Hughes wouldn't shake his hand, apparently, and I don't know whether that was on purpose or not, but regardless, they have a bit of a falling out, and Johnson doesn't campaign for Hughes. Now, to lose California by 2,000 votes, you would have thought that a man as popular as Johnson could have certainly swayed it.
Absolutely. So Teddy Roosevelt, return of the Republican Party. That's, I think our listeners are would be interested in that fact, because he was willing to bolt in 1912, set up his own party. As you say, the Progressive Party itself kind of continues, but he goes back to the Republicans. What brought him back into the fold?
Well, he knew that the Progressive Party had no hope. I mean, they had lost the 1912 election on the top line, but they lost a lot of, you know, congressional governor seats as well. In 1914, it's a complete wipeout as well. Those midterm elections, they, you know, Republicans pick up wins in a lot of places where progressives were hoping that they would pick up wins. And so really, it's after November 1914 that he gives up on the party. And it coincides with the start of World War I as well, which TR is the foremost proponent for American intervention as early as November 1914. So not only is he anti-Wilson, but and definitely anti-Wilson in terms of the neutrality policy that America takes, but he is loudly trying to get old Republican friends on board with his idea of war preparedness and intervention alongside the Allies. So this is really the thing that brings TR back into the Republican Party is the war, and he realizes. You know, as time goes on as well, obviously America gets involved in 1917 in the war, but it's the peace as well that he knows that he has to ally with the Republicans in order to get a deal that he wants out of the peace, which is largely what Henry Cabot Lodge wants. It's not Wilson's peace, it's with reservations, but it of course that never happens either. And Roosevelt dies before a peace treaty would make it to the Senate floor for a vote.
If looking at it, taking a step back, thinking of the Bull Moose Party and Teddy Roosevelt, you've talked about the lasting effect of TR on the presidency and really creating the modern presidency, the idea of third party runs, which inspired others. Are there any other lasting effects or lessons that we can draw from the Bull Moose Party and Teddy Roosevelt?
I mean, I've written about this sometimes before in places like The Hill and elsewhere about what do third parties do? And as I've said a number of times to you, Jeff, you know, it's about moving the dial. I don't think third parties have much of a chance unless we see multiple, like if we go back to 1860 and look at that election, you know, there's four major parties running in that election. And that's what moves the Electoral College. 1826, right? Same thing, four parties running. But we don't really see that in modern elections. We're very much a two-party system. So injecting a third party only winds up spoiling it for one of the two candidates of the major parties. So, and TR knew that, and I think that's why he came back into the fold. It's also why I suspect the likes of No Label wasn't able to put a candidate forward this year, and why third parties don't stand much of a chance. However, the one thing I will say, I mean, we can think about 2000, when you know Nader won. He did win. He moved the dial in Florida. Third party candidates can spoil it for an expected winner. And when the margins are as fine as they are in our polity today, I think third parties can play a major role. So watch out for Robert Kennedy. I mean, who knows who he's going to steal?
Yeah, I was just thinking that exact same thing. And I bet RFK Jr. Is familiar with TR's run.
Absolutely, I would think so too. And I would think also that his media team is thinking about how do I get these two or three big issues that I have out there? You know, we know what those issues are. It's like, you know, no pharma advertising, right? And like less government control over your lives. I mean, these are the things that he's advocating for. His media team is going to say, if we look at previous third party runs, they had a couple of big ideas, and that's what we need to have too.
Fascinating. What an interesting time in American public life and American politics. And as you say, we're still feeling the reverberations from the Bull Moose Party and the 1912 election. Mike Cullinane, thank you for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea. Again, let me recommend Mike's podcast on the Gilded Age and Progressive Era, terrific conversations, and his books, Remembering Theodore Roosevelt and Theodore Roosevelt's Ghost. Mike, thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, Remember to subscribe at Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.